නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස බුද්ධං ධම්මං සංඝං නමස්සාමි.
Question is motivation in practice. it's quite a debated issue, and there are various views on this matter, and it seems to be debated even at the time of the Buddha himself. And there's a sutta in which has come to be almost a classic criticism of Buddha's teachings, that it bears within it an inherent contradiction, in that it is aimed at the ending of desire, but the path cannot be followed without desire. And so the objection is that it's inherently contradictory, self-contradictory, and of course Venerable Ananda gives a bit of simple simile to explain the fallacy in this reasoning, saying just as one has to have wanted to come to the Jeta Grove or wherever it was that he met with the Brahmin who voiced this objection. But once you reach the Jeta Grove, then there's no longer the desire to come to the Jeta Grove. And that desire brought you here. And once you reach the destination, it disappeared. And Ananda spoke about the desire to practice in that way. And the question of desire and motivation is an important one, and the one to keep coming back to, because a wholesome motivation can decline. And without realizing it, may become an unwholesome desire. And similarly, we may start off with an unwholesome desire, but gradually purify that and or transcend the unwholesome desire altogether. That which determines whether a desire is wholesome or unwholesome, because the presence of the roots of greed, hatred and delusion, but perhaps more practically and more interestingly, the criteria we can use is one in which we take the characteristics of tanha, craving, the cause of suffering, the samutaya, dhamma, and look at our desire and motivation and see whether it fulfills those characteristics or not. Now, the nature of tanha or craving is that it desires feeling, desires vetana, sukha vetana, or it desires security or permanence for the sense of self. So it's either bound up with the attainment, the enjoyment of feeling, or is somehow bound up with attachment to the concept, the idea of self, and desire something which will bolster that or uphold it or protect it. A desire which is free of that kind of craving is not called tanha, it's called chanda. And the particular characteristic of chanda is that it is desire for goodness, truth. So if we look at that in view of the Dhamma and the nature of Dhamma, which we divide into path and fruit, and we can say that chandra is that it desires the path, it desires the fruit. I'm not speaking here about the supramundane path of the Arya Pugala, but the path of practice. It desires the good practice, the true practice. It desires the fruits of the practice. So it desires both of those things. And whereas craving or tanha results in search, then the chanda results in action. So chanda is that which leads to purposeful, wise action, because there is the enjoyment and the recognition of the value of the path. It's not just wishing for the fruits of the path. So how does that translate to our meditation practice or our efforts in meditation? It means there is definitely room for, and indeed a necessity for creating goals for yourself, both the higher goals and the highest goal, and also intermediate goals, smaller, more easily attainable goals, and to develop strong sense of aspiration and focus on those goals, not just establishing them as goals, but the more we reflect on them as worthy, noble goals for ourselves, then the emotional ascent and power is tapped into. It's not we have to be able to harness both of these aspects of our being, both the intellectual acceptance and ascent to a goal, but also the emotional ascent, the enthusiasm for the goal. And these two are closely related. Using an intellectual approach and an analysis of the value of the goal, the drawbacks, the suffering inherent in separation from the goal or failure to realize the goal, stimulates the enthusiasm and the ardor for the goal. Yet
the cognitive side, the intellectual precision and carefulness prevents that ardor from becoming foolhardy, or it maintains a sense of circumspection and maturity. There's a balance between the two sides in effort. So the mindfulness that we develop, apart from the moment by moment mindfulness and recollection of our meditation object and our refusal to relinquish it or to be to allow other things to occupy our mind, is complemented by the recollection of the purpose of doing so. This is how we continually reinvigorate and refresh our efforts. And without that, then the effort will very easily become stale or perfunctory. So learning to be able to draw upon the inspiring stories of the great teachers that we've read about, or we may have the good fortune to meet, passages from the suttas and so on, in which we see embodied the goal of practice or the virtuous noble qualities that we are seeking to develop within ourselves, and being able to bring them to mind. So virtuous qualities come to life when they are embodied, when there are, we have particular concrete instances of their expression, perhaps when we have particular times when we've seen that quality in action, or met someone who for us really exemplified that quality. Myself, many years ago, I the opportunity to go to Suan Mo, and the memory of Ajahn Buddhadasa sitting on his seat outside his, in front of his kuti, for me is the most powerful image of equanimity that I could imagine. And I'm aware of the nature of equanimity and the scriptural and commentarial descriptions of it, but bringing to mind that memory of Ajahn Buddhadasa makes it much more real for me. And if we've met beings who possess great peace, who are glowing with loving kindness, and so on, and this, to be able to recollect and bring to mind those kinds of images and memories as a way of encouraging oneself, because it's not that those great monks, those great individuals were the owners of those qualities. They were merely the vessels for them. And any wonderful, inspiring quality that you've ever seen in anyone else, you can be quite sure that you have that quality within yourself. to one degree or another. There's not one wonderful, inspiring spiritual quality that you've ever seen or thought you've seen or perceived in anyone else that you're incapable of developing within yourself, because the seeds are there. And this is the wonder and the value of a human birth, that you have that kind of potential, that every one of us has that kind of potential within us. So this is a way of bringing up the wholesome motivation, the chanda. And the distinction between this chanda and the tanha can sometimes be quite subtle, between the desire to act, to create, to realize, and the desire to enjoy. And to whenever there's a sense of self arising, then we can be sure that the chanda has been sullied or has been infiltrated by tanha. When there's a sense of me as a very peaceful person, me as a wise person, creating images of oneself in a particular way, then the craving started to exert itself and to take over, and the motivation started to slip from the middle path. So chanda, the wise desire, is based on skillful reflection, the technical term for which many of you will know is yoniso manasikara, the ability to think systematically, to reflect in a way that inhibits unwholesome proliferation. Thinking, using the rational thinking faculty, using the imagination, to promote, to encourage, to sustain, wholesome dhammas and good qualities. This is a skillful, wise use of the, cognitive faculty. And this is giving rise to this wise desire. So it's to repeat the point I made a moment ago. It's not only the desire for the fruits of practice, but it's the desire to do what one is doing well, whatever it is. So this quality is of great benefit in whatever sphere of activity, not only in meditation, and we've all experienced that when where we do something and we want to do that task as well as we possibly can, and we take joy in the work itself. And that's the essence of chanda, to take on whatever task we have, and whether it's a task we like or a task we don't like, one that we feel that we're skilled in, we're not skilled in, that we have some real gift, or we feel hopeless at, and to hold that and honor that task. And to give oneself, to surrender oneself to that task totally, and to seek to do the best that one possibly can with the task that one has. This is the chanda that is of so much value in every sphere of life. And in meditation, it means we're taking joy in every single step of the path, the ups and the downs, the good times and the bad times, the successes and the failures, but seeing beyond the effective component of the or aspect of each situation, that is, whether we feel good about it or bad about it, whether we're happy or sorrowful, but to dwell in the appreciation of the activity itself, and the fact that we have the incredible good fortune to have taken a human birth, one in which we have a healthy, reasonably healthy human body, one that at least allows us to study and practice the Dhamma, that we've had the good fortune to have come into contact with the Buddha's teaching and to have been able to have the freedom, the financial freedom, or the time, the leisure, if you like, to have been able to devote our lives, or some part of our lives, or some period of our lives, to this practice. Never to, and this is perhaps the most important virtue in Buddha. In fact, talks about it as being the elephant's footprint, this sense of never taking anything at all for granted. And that not taking anything for granted means the ability to start again, and that beginner's mind that Suzuki Roshi talks about, and to recognize and to awaken again to how wonderful it is that we can do this, that we have this opportunity to sit meditation, to walk, to practice, to purify our minds, and that this effort, the effort to be mindful, the effort to be present, the effort to eschew all distractions, this effort is what truly ennobles us. And sometimes we forget, sometimes we lose it, but we come back to it because our underlying aim, the deepest need in our heart, is to do this. And the more we do it, then the more we realize that our ability and our capacity to lie to ourselves and cheat ourselves is being eroded moment by moment. And it's something very special is happening. It may be happening at a very, very slow pace, but every single moment, every single mind moment of sincere effort it's not an exaggeration. It has a cosmic significance. It has an incredibly profound significance. If you're looking this at through the Buddhist cosmology, and if you you can take this on trust that we have, presuming that you can't remember past lives, that you've been born millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of lifetimes. And if you can look on that kind of time scale, then that one lifetime and all those millions and millions and millions and millions of lifetimes where you reach the Dhamma, you contact the Dhamma, and you start to practice. That's why I don't feel it's an exaggeration or it's hyperbole to talk about some cosmic significance. It's a wonderful thing. So we've met the Dhamma. We have access to the teachings. And we have the work to do. And now to develop this love for the work, this devotion to the work of meditation. We really want to do it. I want to do it well. Just like any other job that we've done. You may have a work of art that you've created, or it might be building a wall, or some very practical kind of endeavor that you've been involved in your life. Anything that where you've got that, you remember that kind of thing. You just want to do this well. And you go into it very, very intimately. You know just exactly what's involved in doing this job. What's the best way? What are the best materials? What's the best technique? What kind of mental attitudes and properties are needed? It's a sense of really wanting to do this well. And with meditation, it's really wanting to meditate well, to put everything into it, to surrender yourself to it, to give it all you've got. And this is based on the faith, confidence, in the Buddhist words, monks, I tell you to abandon unwholesome dhammas because it's something you can do. I tell you to develop wholesome dhammas because it's something that you can do. If you couldn't do these things, the Tathagata wouldn't tell you to do them. But it's because you do, you can do them, you have the capacity to do this, so the Tathagata teaches you to do it. The Tathagata teaches us to develop sila, to perfect our sila, to teaches us to practice meditation, to penetrate the nature of peace, to experience peace fully, to let peace suffuse the whole body. Have every single pore of the body fully immersed in peace, the mind completely free of all of its burdens and of all of its trivial distractions and obsessions and thoughts and desires and fears and anxieties. And this is not a kind of a dream or a fantasy. It's something that is extremely possible. It's a goal within the grasp of all of us by following the Buddha's instructions, and moment by moment putting down the distraction and inclining the mind towards the meditation object with humility, with faith, with contentment, with determination. So, a love for the practice. If the word love seems too intense, then there is the developing through reflection, through consideration, a really positive attitude towards the meditation. So, something that you want to do, you have It's not something that you have to kind of push yourself to do, or you find yourself almost despite yourself looking for other things to do. The sign when the meditation is going well is when you're really looking for more and more time to do it, and you're really keen to do it. And that keenness and that wanting to do it is not just dependent on, you know, having had a good meditation this morning. But it's something that's deeper than that. It's more profound than particular meditation experiences. Just this real inspiration with the path of practice. And then when there's inspiration with the path and with the actual treading the path and the exhilaration of step along the path that you follow. And Ajahn Chah, you know what's your responsibility. You plant the tree. Your responsibility is watering the tree and protecting the tree. And the tree grows fast or slow. The fruit's sweet or whatever. That's nature. You know what's your responsibility, and you do with that with great consideration, effort. And this is this other quality of determination and resoluteness. It's a warrior spirit that we're talking about. You need that. You can't be too soft and easygoing in meditation. There is a place for that kind of relaxation and easygoingness, but at the same time there must be that kind of iron fist in the velvet glove. There has to be that sense of toughness and daring and courage. You know, those kind of virtues are traditionally called the masculine virtues, but they're not necessarily restricted to males, but that you have to be able to draw upon that side of your nature. So there's that love and devotion for the path of practice, inspiration with the goal, resoluteness, courage, daring, willingness to put your life on the line, as Ajahn Chah used to say. And then there's that complete dedication and turning away from all that's distracting, even things that we really like and enjoy. And this is where we get to the real nub, the real heart of renunciation. A lot of the things that we renounce, in a way we can say it's not so much renunciation, in that we'd already found ourselves kind of shrinking away from those things or finding them unappetizing and bland. But there are still things, aren't there, which we do enjoy, and we're not really sure whether we want to let go of those just yet or not. It's like you want some kind of a safety net. Practice really starts to mature when we begin to say we can do without the safety net. We can walk along the high wire without anything underneath. We don't need anything in reserve. And we're able to renounce not just the things we don't like, but we're able to renounce the things we do like. And to be uplifted by that renunciation. It's not just kind of gritting your teeth, kind of renunciation, but really inspired with the ability to renounce and seeing the beauty and the unusual, compelling nobility of the renouncing mind. And then this is not a path where we just have to shut down our critical faculties and follow the path of faith. And the critical faculty still has a role to play. It's not neglected, it's not overlooked, it's not disparaged, but it's focused, it's brought into play in the service of the path, constantly looking for ways of improving one's practice, of cutting down on the defilements, finding skillful means of dealing with particular difficulties that you have. Everyone has different strengths and weaknesses, and you can be creative in your practice. You don't have to just follow what it says in the books, or even doesn't have to be one of the 40 Kamatana and the Visuddhimagga, whatever works. And you can be creative. We have the basic principles, and you have you've experienced within the nature of merit and demerit, and what the clarity and purity of mind feels like, what the unclarity and cloudiness and the impurity of mind feels like. Then you have you have your inner principle, and you have your inner criteria to judge, you know, whether things are working or not. You use that faculty, experiment with things, try things out, learn from mistakes, don't dwell on them and create a self. I'm hopeless, I'm terrible, I'm never going to be able to do this, or I'm great, I'm better than everybody else, or with not allowing that kind of self-based proliferation to arise, but learning from the dhammas that arise in the heart, and looking and analyzing the causal structures underlying the wholesome and unwholesome dhammas, working with cause and effect, working with the conditioning process, to refine, develop meditation. Meditation techniques are intentionally simple, to cut through the addiction to complexity and to confusion that we have, and developing this real affection and devotion to your meditation object. This is what's going to take you beyond the conditioned world. What a great debt of gratitude you owe to that meditation object. How wonderful it is that you've learned about this meditation object. So the more that you can think in this kind of vein, then the more the mind just naturally inclines towards it. So it's an old friend, or it's a teacher, it's something that we like to be with, we want to be with. Developing this practice, bringing the mind back to the object again and again and again, very, very patiently, but with great resolution and determination, and balancing effort and relaxation, and balancing the faith and the critical faculty, using mindfulness, and keeping this continuity of practice from within the different postures, just be awaking to the particular needs, the
the situation as it is right now. What exactly is needed? What's appropriate? What's the balanced response to the challenge of now, moment by moment? Keeping this going through the sitting, through the walking, and through whatever activities we have through the day, and contain the sense of evenness and consistency throughout the whole period. Eating just the right amount, sleeping, resting just the right amount, finding that sense of just rightness or podi, which is the key to the middle path. Way. So these are a few preliminary reflections and thoughts about the way of practice I'd like to share with you this evening.